Hello and welcome back to this special episode of PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is our 100th episode. And whilst that's a fairly small achievement in itself, breaking into triple figures is a milestone to be celebrated by any podcast. So a big thanks to all of our listeners, especially those of you who've been with us since day one. Things have really changed a lot since that first episode, especially in how we sound. We've managed to increase audio quality where we can, and from today we'll be using this new intro theme. It's been especially created for the show by the supremely talented Patrick Kendall, so I hope you all like it. The other area in which we've seen the most change is in our expanding lineup of contributors, and we've got a new member of the PaleoCast team on his first interview today, so I'd like to introduce you all to Vish Van Katt. How you doing, Vish?
Not too bad, Dave, and it's great to be here. Thank you.
We really should introduce you to everyone. So can you give us the lowdown of who you are, where you're from, what you're studying, what you're doing, what you're about?
Absolutely. So I am a second-year doctoral student at the University of Chicago in the Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy. And I'm currently being advised by Michael Coates, who some of you may be familiar with, and Victoria Prince, who's a zebrafish developmental biologist. So currently I'm working at the intersection of paleontology and evolutionary developmental biology, focusing on the evolution of sensory systems in jawed fishes, particularly the lateral line system. Before this, Dave, I was actually a master's student in paleobiology at the University of Bristol, and I worked with Phil Donahue in describing the dermal tissues of fossil Sarcopterygians. And before that, I did an undergraduate degree in integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley.
So you're going to be doing a lot more interviews for us all in the very near future. So what kinds of subjects and which interviewees are you looking to speak to?
So I think, for a start, we have a great constellation of paleontologists in Chicago and in the Midwest, at Ann Arbor and so forth. And what I'm really interested in is sort of interdisciplinary work in paleontology. So, my first interview was with Neil, whose lab is literally split 50-50 between development and paleontology. And there's people like Zariah Lemsaged, who's been doing work on human origins in Ethiopia, who looks at a lot of stratigraphy and paleontology, but also modeling and biomechanics. There's, of course, Paul Serino at Chicago, who's been doing these sort of questions about anatomy, modularity, and morphogenesis for a very long time. My own advisor, Mike Coates, also sort of works in that intersection of different kinds of approaches to paleontological questions. So then what I'm really interested in is finding and talking to people who sit at the center of those Venn diagrams of different fields. And there's a lot of that here, and I'm really looking forward to introducing their work and discussing their ideas.
Awesome, I look forward to it.
Absolutely, likewise.
In other news, and just to update you all on a couple of things, I've just taken the opportunity to go back to working as a micropaleontologist in the oil industry. This will hopefully free up a whole load of my time and I'll be able to properly support my self-funded PhD and all the other outreach activities that I do. But it does mean that my schedules are now out of the window since I've got to go to work at the drop of a hat. So just letting you know that releases may be a little patchy, at least for a little while. But that's why it's important that we've got Vish and all the other members of the team to be able to help out. On the subject of money, we don't run ads on PaleoCast, and that's not for a lack of ads that we could stick in, but because we hate them ourselves, and we're not putting your ears up for sale. But we do rely on listener donations, which at the moment just about cover the cost of the show and our website. But anything you could chip in would really help us improve things and make sure that we're around for another 100 episodes. Anyway, that's more than enough from me, and so on to this episode. This is an interviewee that we've had lots of requests for in the past, and so we're happy to be able to get such a big name onto the show. If you enjoy the podcast, then likes, comments, reviews, subscriptions, basically anything you can do on social media would be hugely appreciated. Thanks for listening today, and we hope you enjoy this interview with Neil Shubin.
Hello and welcome to another edition of PaleoCast. My name is Vish Venkat and we have with us a very special visitor today. We're going to be speaking to Dr. Neil Shubin, Professor of Organismal Biology and Anatomy at the University of Chicago and best-selling author of Your Inner Fish. Neil, thank you for being with us today.
Well, it's great to be here.
So to start out with a general introduction, we like to ask about your evolution. So tell us about your evolution as a paleontologist and how you got started and how you got here.
Well, my evolution as a paleontologist began when I was a college student in New York in the late 70s. I had didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I might be a veterinarian. I kind of grew up with that sort of passion. And I ended up actually, after taking a class in human evolution in my freshman year, volunteering at the American Museum of Natural History.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so what I did at the AMNH was to catalog specimens and helping out there. And I sort of got the paleo bug there. I did not have a paleo bug as a kid. I was not one of these kids who loved dinosaurs. I did love documentaries and Carl Sagan. So that one thing led to another. I got on an expedition run by Malcolm McKenna in my junior year and looking for fossil mammals and then went to graduate school. And I really fell in love with the expeditionary side. And so I sort of co-trained in geology and anatomy. But then in my second year of graduate school, took developmental biology. So that's when it all came together.
Yeah. Right. That's fantastic. And I think you sort of answered this question already, but what would you have done if you weren't a paleontologist?
That would have been a veterinarian, maybe. Not a very good one, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe an archaeologist, maybe an astronomer.
Yeah.
Cool. Maybe unemployed.
Yeah. Right. Cool. And I think this is an important question to ask you, but you've worked a great deal in the intersection of science and society. You've been an advisor to President Obama. You've worked with the Vatican and so on. Can you tell us more about the different roles your research has brought you?
Well, one of the things that's really wonderful about being a paleontologist is it puts you at the center of many important issues in public communication, in people's conception of our place in nature and in how science works and so forth. And it does so with a discipline that's relatively, I wouldn't say easy, but ready to communicate very broadly, you know, and I've always been able to sort of, I've always worked, I should say, to sort of leverage that, to leverage the discoveries of paleontology to inform people about science and the power of science more generally, to help people understand evolution and the importance of understanding evolution more generally. And paleontology has been just a wonderful entree to all that for many people. And I've really tried to leverage that, and it's worked. You know, for me, it's been a real joy because I've been able to communicate that to many different kinds of audiences over the years.
I think it's interesting since you brought up evolution that you've been visiting the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in the Vatican. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and your role as a sort of bridging the gap between, say, science and religion?
Well, in that case in particular, I was really just invited to present on the history of life. And, you know, it was a very warm, cordial welcome. I talked about 4 billion years of the evolution of the history of evolution on our planet. I talked about your inner fish, mass extinctions, you know, all the stuff that we're very familiar with as paleontologists, but people who are not in the field might not be, might not be. You know, like you think about inner fish. You know, the concept of your inner fish is there's just nothing revolutionary about it whatsoever if you're a scientist. But if you're a non-scientist, it's a big revolutionary jump. And so I love like connecting those disconnects. And, you know, it's doing it whether at the Vatican or whether it, like today I did a Skype call with a high school class in Iowa. You know, it's the same. Really, you know, it's
That's wicked. That's wicked. Since you actually made that amazing segue into your inner fish, we're going to talk about the tetrapod transition. And you're arguably most famous for finding what's arguably the world's most famous fish, so Tiktaalik. And so could you tell us about why is it so important and briefly the story of its discovery?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about why Tiktaalik is important, I think it's actually less about the fossil and more about the discovery story. You know, because when you think about the fossil Tiktaalik, it's a great fossil. And it's not just one. It's, you know, we have 20 individuals. And one of the great things about it is we have multiple specimens preserved both in articulation and isolated in the round, different growth stages. So it's not just one thing. We really are capturing a window of a taxon at a particular moment in time. The thing that's powerful about it is it does tell us quite a bit with other fossils, with Elpistostegi, with Pandorichthys, with Acanthostega. You know, when you embed it in a phylogenetic framework, it really tells us about this, it helps to tell us about the sequence of changes involved with the origin of tetrapods. But, you know, what's really relevant about it also, and I think even in some ways even more important when we talk about public communication, is the discovery story.
Right.
Because we didn't find it by accident.
Right, right.
And I think, you know, when you convey that fact to a general audience who is not familiar with paleontology, and you show them the power of paleontology as a way of knowing, and how the tools of paleontology can help you discover and make predictions, all of a sudden it's kind of a gee whiz moment for a lot of people.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so that is quite powerful. You know, linking the discovery story to the fossil itself. And in fact, when I'm at a general, when I'm talking to a general audience, or even to when I'm talking to a scientific audience, whether it's at the National Academy of Sciences or whether it's at a molecular biology institute, I focus on the discovery story.
Right.
Because it has a power to it, the predictive power of paleontology, using the stratigraphic record, using, time-calibrated phylogenies, you know, using these things to make discoveries is not something people are familiar with.
Right.
And they say, wow, you can actually target nodes.
You can think about these things. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Let me actually break that down into two questions since you brought the discovery story up. One is, how do you make a decision about where to look? So how did you establish Arctic Canada as a site? And the second question is, when the work of paleontology is being done, when you ask these questions, how do you decide what you look for? So do you have a search image for Tiktaalik like that? You would expect something at this point in the phylogeny to have these features and not these features, with a specific, say, example of Tiktaalik.
Yeah, sure thing. So when I was a graduate student, I was in the second year of my graduate program, and I didn't know what I wanted to do for a thesis. And so I really, honestly, loved it all. And I'm like, I don't know what I want to do. So I took this graduate course. It was a seminar on the greatest hits in vertebrate evolution.
Oh, right. Okay.
And every week was a different transformation. And I remember, like, in week three, it was the origin of tetrapods. And we had learned about, we knew a little bit about Pandorichthys at the time. We knew a little bit about Ichthyostega at the time. This was in the early 80s, 1980s. And I fell in love with the question then, right? And so I was training to be a field paleontologist working on the origin of mammals. Triassic systems at the time. And literally what I was doing in the Triassic system was trying to find places in the world that had rocks of the right age to find early mammals, right? Rocks of the right type to hold those fossils, and rocks that are exposed that we can access. Then I remember thinking, well, why work on mammals? I could find like walking fish or something like that. So that's literally when it began in the mid-1980s. Wow. I was like, rocks of the right age, right? You're going to go to middle late Devonian. Rocks of the right type, you're going to go to deltaic sediments, near shore to estuarian to rivers. You know, the sediments that reflect that.
Right.
And you're going to places in the world that have rocks that are exposed.
Right.
You know, you apply those three filters.
Right.
All of a sudden, the big world becomes a whole lot smaller.
Right.
And so we had a whole bunch of candidate places, and we started working in the Devonian of Pennsylvania simply because it was easier and cheaper and local. Found some tetrapods there. But then it became clear that we really needed to work a little earlier in time, so lower in the Devonian. And then the Arctic Canada became just this. We found Ted Deschler has been my colleague in this for years. Was originally a graduate student with me, and now we're just, you know, we've been working together as colleagues. It became clear Arctic Canada was like the obvious place that was underexplored.
Right.
You know, we had 1,500 kilometers of exposed section east to west across the Canadian Arctic Isle, all isles, all of middle to late Devonian age, all from deltaic sediments, so we could sample ancient seas, ancient estuaries, ancient rivers and streams, and it's all exposed. So you add that all up. You
know, right.
You wonder why we weren't there. That's why.
Right.
You know, and we figured it would be a multi-year project.
That's brilliant. So how long did it take for you to find Tiktaalik, had to get what you possibly were looking for?
Yeah, it took us 6 years. And so that was a long time. But, you know, I was used to that because I had worked in Greenland for a number of years. And it took us 5 years to find the earliest mammals. So
right,
I had told, you know, we had decided we're going to stick on this thing for a while because it's not going to happen in the first year.
Right.
Probably wouldn't happen the second year, nor probably likely in the third.
Right.
But we'd have to really, the Arctic's a big place, and we're just going to have to sit on this for a long time.
Right.
So Ted and I set up a funding structure where we can do that. And it took us 4 seasons over 6 years, a lot of work to find the first Tiktaalik. Then we found many more in the succeeding
season. You said there's about 20 individuals so far. How long does it take for you to get those out of the field and into collections or labs, kind of the pipeline?
Yeah, I'd say about, you know, using manual preparation methods, about a year and a half, 2 years once we've collected them.
Wow,
to prepare.
Okay.
So the type specimen, that iconic one you see around, that Fred Mullison prepared that was took about a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And then the bigger ones, the ones that are the really great fins, they took longer, actually. They probably took about 2 years.
So, and, you know, speaking again of the Canadian Arctic, do you think there's opportunity to find more in that region of the phylogeny, the stuff there that...
Oh, golly, yeah. Oh, my goodness, yeah. There's tons of rock we haven't looked at yet. And see, part of the thing about finding Tiktaalik is we stopped exploring the Canadian Arctic at that point because we stuck in that one hole that had all the Tiktaalik specimens. But there's a whole vast part that right. I'd like to return to of different time periods.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, there's much more to explore.
So, and, you know, just, again, kind of going off the time period, why the late Devonian as opposed to the middle or the early?
Yeah, well, if you look at the skeletal fossils, which are unambiguous,
uh-huh.
the earliest digited creatures really aren't until Feminian,
right.
which is late Devonian.
Right, right.
You know, and if you looked earlier in time, you have creatures like Pandorichthys and Alpistis stegi,
mm-hmm.
which are Tiktaalik-like creatures.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they're still in late Devonian. They're in the Frannian stage.
Right.
So that's kind of the window if you're looking for the bones.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We have a little PSA from Paleocast. So our regular host, Dave Marshall, was actually in Arctic Canada last summer looking for the earliest nathostomes in the fossil record with Dr. Martin Brazeau of Imperial College. So if any of you want to know what research is like in the Arctic in that regard, he's recorded hours of video and audio in the field. So please do check that out at paleocast.com/the-expedition. And in fact, Neil, apparently his team borrowed your waders and sleeping mats.
More than that, they borrowed our kitchen tent. We have a fabulous kitchen tent up there that we have a locker with all this stuff.
And so he passes on his thanks to you and Ted for keeping him dry and letting him get to sleep in relative comfort. So speaking of Ted Dashler, he's also appeared on the show talking about Devonian vertebrates. And in general, there seems to be, as you pointed out, a slew of transitional forms on the road from fish to tetrapod, you know, Acanthostega, Ichthyostega, and so forth, which you also write about in detail in Inner Fish. So kind of poking at that again, where does Tiktaalik fit and why is it sort of important to the story? What puzzle does that do? What does Tiktaalik tell us that the other fossils did not so far?
So what it has, it's the sister group of digited creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So creatures with limbs with digits, it's the sister group. It's the closest relative.
Right.
What it shows is, you know, you have a creature with a neck, loss of, they have no operculum.
Right.
They have a massive, there's some things that are surprising, some things that aren't surprising.
Uh-huh.
What's not surprising at all is it has a shoulder, elbow, and components of a wrist.
Right.
We knew that.
Right.
But since we have the joints so well preserved, we can see how they articulate. We can see the ranges of motion.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at the sizes and shapes, the different portions of the flexor and extensor musculature. Mm-hmm. But even more broadly, we can see the sequence of changes that gave rise to tetrapodness. And what's surprising, really, is that these creatures had huge hind fins.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's an enigma in many ways.
Uh-huh.
And so we want to figure that out a little bit more. But, you know, in terms of developing a neck and developing appendage-based support, Tiktaalik is showing very much how that happened.
Right. Okay. So, again, since you mentioned sort of what we know about its biology, recent work with one of your grad students, Justin Lemberg, has focused on the feeding biomechanics of Tiktaalik. So could you tell us how you were able to infer how it ate?
So that's really surprising. So if you look at the skull of Tiktaalik, you know, just superficially, it looks like just a flat-headed fish, you know?
Uh-huh.
But when you scan these things in a CT scanner, what you see is a complexity of the sutural connections among the different bones of the skull.
Right.
And it turns out some of these sutures are scarf joints. They're like plate on plate. And it looks like they're capable of a degree of cranial kinesis.
Uh-huh.
And that's like the last skull you'd think that
uh-huh.
would have a kind of cranial kinesis to
uh-huh.
it. Yeah, we know of one intracranial joint. We've known that for a long time.
Right.
But of the dermal bones of the skull?
Uh-huh.
Come on. So Justin started to poke around with that. And he was trying to think, are there any good flat-headed fish out there that both use suction feeding and biting in the water?
Uh-huh.
And it turns out alligator gars were perfect.
Right.
So we spent a lot of time imaging alligator gars
uh-huh.
feeding in the water.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out they have a remarkable pattern of cranial kinesis,
uh-huh.
where the skull expands as they, you know, when they open the gate, the skull expands.
Right.
The hyoid and the shoulder and all these different components form a system that works in series
mm-hmm.
to both, you know, create the suction to bring prey into the mouth, but uh-huh. also to generate force for biting as well.
Right.
Really remarkable. It turns out that when you look at those motions in the gar and what sort of musculoskeletal inventions allow that to happen, Tiktaalik has all those as well, including
right.
the configuration of the joints.
Right.
So Justin was able to model these things really well, and that's going to appear fairly soon, is to show how cranial kinesis acts
uh-huh.
as Tiktaalik both bites and uses suction feeding. It's really remarkable.
That's
a very real intermediate between
uh-huh.
you know, between suction feeding and biting, these things are doing both.
Both,
which
right.
kind of makes sense. So TikTok's doing both of everything, right?
Right.
It's got limbs
right.
and fins. It's got gills and
it's kind of really in the middle of things.
It right. really is. Right. It's really, and we're only able to do that because the material is so high quality.
Right.
It's not just the phylogenetic position of Tiktaalik, because that's important.
Right.
But it's multiple specimens, three-dimensional, preliminarily preserved, and so forth, that really gives us access to these, answering these questions.
Right. So kind of going a broader picture of, based on those feeding studies and limb proportions and things, what can we infer about the paleoecology of Tiktaalik? How do we think it lived? Where did it live? And what do we think the mode of life was?
I think it's living in the water. I think it's living in the benthos and the shallows. Mm-hmm. I think it's specializing for life in, on a harder substrate on the bottom of the water or in the shallows.
Right.
Whether it can make forays in the mud flats, yes, I think it could.
Right.
You know, so I think it's that range of environments from benthic to shallow water, to the occasional mudflat environment,
right.
I think it's a continuum.
Right, right.
That creatures like Tiktaalik were exploiting.
Uh-huh.
Because if you look at the appendages, if you look at respiration, if you mm-hmm. look at feeding, it could function in all that.
Right.
And indeed, if you think about where they're living, which is these shallow freshwater streams,
uh-huh.
specializing on those the water bottom as well as the margins,
right.
there's a lot of hay to be made there.
Right, I mean, right.
A lot of prey, avoidance of predators.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a thing.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what we think they're doing.
Okay. And kind of a final sort of question about a cautionary note. So Justin used alligator gauze as a model. So, you know, some people might think that there's a reasonable amount of phylogenetic distance between those two organisms. So when you make comparisons like these, what kind of precaution should you take in how you're framing the hypothesis?
Well, in Justin's case, I mean, he was aided by the fact that the joints are very similar of the relevant bones that allow those motions.
Okay.
So they have a similar shaped hyoid. They have a similar position to our shoulder girdle. If you look at the scarf joint they have among the different bones that have cranial kinesis, that's similar to Tiktaalik as well.
Right.
So they were similar in ways that we can make the morphological comparison.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's like an analog if you look at
right.
that.
Right.
Not a homolog.
Right, exactly. Okay. So sort of moving aside from Tiktaalik, you continue to run an expeditionary research program in the Antarctic, in the South Pole, focused on Sarcopterygians, that's the lobe-finned fish. So are you intending on finding another big sort of transitional fossil from fish to tetrapods? In other words, what part of the tree are you looking to fill here?
Here we're looking deeper in time. So we're looking at, you know, so really the stem that contains not only Tiktaalik, but as working further down the stem to rhizodontids.
Right.
See, one of the most enigmatic of these fossils in this part of the tree of life are creatures called rhizodontids. They can get quite big. They can get very tetrapod-like. In fact, they seem to have very tetrapod-like characteristics, that some of which may have evolved independently
right.
in rhizodontids. And who knows? If we find enough of them, maybe it's not independent. Maybe they were having the wrong part of the tree.
Right, right.
So I've really been interested in those ever since Ted and I found this creature called Cerypterus back in the 1990s.
Uh-huh.
And this part of the Antarctica is in the Middle Devonian.
Uh-huh.
It is deltaic sediments. Mm-hmm. It is fossiliferous as you can possibly imagine.
Right.
Intensely so.
Uh-huh.
So we have just fossil bed after fossil bed.
Uh-huh.
And it gives us access to early sharks, placoderms, rhizodontids, other kinds of, you know, tetrapodomorph fossils, things of this relevant part of the tree. So yeah, I mean, it's a window. Basically, what we have is a window into an important moment in the history of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that, because almost anything we find will be interesting.
Will be interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about sort of how fieldwork compares between the Arctic and the Antarctic, the kind of preservation, the kind of work that you need to do to get the fossils out and so forth?
Well, let's just talk about living there. So like, you know, you have penguins in Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
You have polar bears in the Arctic.
Right.
Penguins don't eat people, so that's a big difference between the two, okay? So we don't have to carry guns or sleep with guns, you know, like we did in the Antarctic. But Antarctica is much, much, much more intense.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, minus 20 degrees, you know, minus 40 wind chill. And so, you know, centigrade and Fahrenheit don't matter at that point.
Right,
It's cold. So, you know, in terms of working there, it's really challenging. Because the whole place is like a salvage operation. You might only have a couple hours on a particular rock.
Right.
And those hours might be at minus 20 and you're freezing and you can't use glue because your hands freeze.
Right.
You know, and so that's really challenging. These rocks were great though.
Right.
Because they were so fossiliferous that we were able to camp right on them.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so that helped a lot. We lost a lot of days to weather, but given that we were so close to the rock, when we had good weather, we could really mine it.
Okay, that's fantastic. So for sort of the other part of our discussion, let's sort of move away from Antarctica and the Arctic back to Chicago. So here in Chicago, you're one of the few paleontologists in the field with an active research program in developmental biology. So can you sort of tell us what developmental biology means to you and why this foray happened?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about developmental biology, you're talking about how animals are built in a single generation, typically, right? So from egg to adult, you're looking at the mechanisms by which patterns emerge, organs form. You're looking at, you know, the toolkit that builds bodies.
Right.
And obviously, the evolutionary changes we're looking at are happening because of changes to that developmental and genetic and cellular tissue level programs. And so really gaining access to that has been very important. And in fact, this started literally in my second year of graduate school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I did my thesis on development and evolution of limbs. That was my thesis in 1987. And it was all histological. I was looking at cellular and tissue level properties of development. But that's just about when Hox genes started to be published.
Right.
And I remember seeing those papers thinking, oh, I need to be a molecular biologist.
Right.
So that's kind of when I sort of shifted a bit and trained into there. And so what my lab does now is we're looking at, you know, morphological evolution using the tools of paleontology, namely the discovery-based tools of expeditionary paleontology and new, you know, ways of imaging. But importantly, going from, you know, chromatin architecture, regulatory genetics, looking at gene function, you know, using everything from CRISPR-Cas to modern, you know, single-cell RNA-seq sequencing, ask at the service of the same question as paleontology,
right,
which is how do morphological changes happen, how to measure. And so I see paleontology and CRISPR-Cas, genome editing, as two different kinds of tools that allow us access to the same
kinds of questions. That's fantastic. So,
so that's the toolkit, right?
Kind of zooming in on, as you say, the toolkit that you can use to answer these questions. So one of the questions you've been interested in is fin limb transitions. And we've talked about fin limb transitions in the context of the fossils in Tiktaalik. So people in your lab have worked on the genetics of the fin limb transition. So can you tell us how this informs our questions about past lives?
Well, if you look, think about it this way. If you look at the fossils at the fin to limb transition, there are lots of transitions going
on. Right.
There's two big ones. One is you lose the fin race, which is the dermal skeleton.
Yes.
Right. As you go from creatures like Tiktaalik to Acanthostega. And the other is you have the arginate digits. You know, you have a distal component that, you know, that's ancient that you see in Tiktaalik, but it doesn't have digits per se. So we're looking at that at a developmental level, using zebrafish and gar and other critters to ask that question. And one of the amazing things is when you look at, say, mouse or chicken limb development, certain of the Hox genes are real markers for the wrist and digits.
Right. Okay.
If you map their activity and trace it into adults, they almost perfectly map to the wrist and digits. If you knock them out, like embryos lacking those genes, you will miss the wrist and digits. You have a humerus, radius and ulna, and no wrist and digits.
Right.
So in the knockout world and in the cell lineage world, they're markers for the wrist and digits.
Right.
So we basically asked the question for a number of years is, well, what happens in fish?
Right. Right.
It turns out when you do those same experiments in fish, the equivalent of the wrists and digits is the fin race.
Which
was incredibly surprising.
Right. Right.
Now, that's not to say that we're saying that wrists and digits are homologous to fin race.
Right.
But the cells that make wrists and digits in mice and people and chickens and frogs are the same cell, homologous cells to those that form the fin rays in fish.
Right.
Which is really a game-changing, remarkable thing. It's a trade-off.
It is.
And so it fits. Here's where the paleontological and the developmental work together. That was about 8 years worth of molecular work right there.
Wow.
You think it took us 6 years to find Tiktaalik. It took us 8 years to do those because we were looking at regulatory genetics, we were looking at gene expression, and then it took a long time to get the CRISPR-Cas knockouts to work because these were the early days of CRISPR-Cas. This is one of the first applications of it to evolution. And in fact, it was. And it's like 2013. And we started doing it. And remember, these fish have multiple copies of every gene. So you can't knock out one. You got to do a bunch.
You
got to
knock all of them out.
And animals love their Hox genes, so they don't like to survive when you knock them out. So we had a lot of puzzles to solve. So Tetsuya Nakamura, who was in my lab at the time, Andrew Garrick, who was in my lab at the time, Igor Schneider, who was in my lab at the time, they were the ones who really, really stuck to it really hard.
Right.
And I was their cheerleader.
Right.
Saying, you can do this. And so, you know, when we did it, their experiments would fail, and I'd give them, you know, it took us 6 years to find tectolic speech, you know, which is like, because what happens when your experiments don't work, I'd give you the, it took us 6 years to find tectolic speech, to start cheering them up.
Right.
And they, you know, they hated that. But it took them 8 years, but they did it.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially given that they had this sort of broad phylogenetic sampling. They were looking at not just at the model system, but at sort of other informative taxa, right?
We also got lucky because the GAR genome came out at the same time while we were doing all that stuff.
Perfect. So, you know, kind of tying those threads together, your research, as we've seen, traverses two very different fields, right? So logistically, what do you think are the challenges with this? And what advice would you give upcoming evolutionary biologists in order to sort of navigate those challenges and building a lab that does both?
Yeah, I think what you need to do is focus like a laser beam on the questions. If you define the questions right, and what that means is a question that's interesting, compelling, that gains you access to fundamental biological or geological phenomena or mechanisms.
Right.
Then you marshal the tools to answer it, right?
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, you look at these as tools, and you deploy the best tools at the right time. The challenge is, of course, that these are very, very different methodologies, right?
Right.
You know, living in a tent in Antarctica is very different from, you know, making guide RNAs and, you know, engineering CRISPR-Cas knockouts.
Right.
But I think the thing to do is not be scared to try, not be scared to be a little fearless about it.
Uh-huh.
If you're scared of failure, this is the wrong line of work.
Uh-huh.
You know, I fail more than I'm successful.
Right.
You know,
right.
But nobody remembers my failures. They just remember when I'm successful. So, I mean, that works out in my favor because I fail a lot. But that's kind of it. If you're not failing, you're not trying. I guess that's the motto.
Right. That's fantastic to know. And before we sort of wrap up with your big thoughts, I think we should definitely talk a little bit about science communication. This is something you've played a large role in while you work at the university, with your classes, with your writing, and with your broadcasting work. So how did that get a start? How did you jump into science communication?
Well, you know, I was always been a paleontologist whose, you know, work occasionally would make a newspaper.
Uh-huh.
And so I was used to trying to distill the central issues and points to a broader audience of a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in the like the early 2000s is I was writing I was teaching comparative anatomy. I was teaching anatomy to medical students. And so I wanted to write a comparative anatomy textbook.
Uh-huh.
And that's how Interfish was born. I was writing a traditional comparative anatomy textbook.
Right.
Then I saw a great one, Kenneth Cardong's book came out, and I'm like, I can't do better than that. So, but I think what I can do better in is maybe I can take all those stories, or a lot of them, and go from molecules to fossils, which is my passion, and do that for a general audience.
Right.
And so I started to do it, and it was like, oh, this is going to be really boring.
Uh-huh.
This is going to suck.
Uh-huh.
And so what I decided to do was to make it all about us, your inner fish. Make it about you, that you are, you know, so basically make it really anthropocentric. We're taught not to do that, but in this case, I thought it'd be a great idea to talk about, you know, the history of fish and worms and yeast inside of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that became it. So the idea was to use the stories of discovery to show people the power of evolutionary thinking and to do so not by preaching them, but by showing it through the discoveries. And so that's been the space I've been in as a public speaker and as a writer, really thinking about, you know, the power of discovery, the power of science's exploration and then that how we do that exploration has human elements, right? Because these are people succeeding and failing and taking chances or getting lucky or making good guesses or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So the human piece, but also the scientific piece, how we structure a scientific, and not a guess, but a hypothesis and approach. And so that's kind of been kind of the way I've used, the vehicle I've used to communicate more broadly.
I think one of the things I remember reading Inner Fish as a first year undergraduate at Berkeley when Leslie Hluska was teaching a class on it. And one of my favorite parts of it was also, in a very Gouldian way, in a sense, focusing on the human stories of these discoveries, you know, Gustav Saf Soderbergh and people who were playing with the embryos and how these personalities played into these stories. So I think it's really fantastic that as you say, the human story in this larger theme is also something we think about or we probably don't think about often enough.
That's right. There are people making these discoveries. And you know, I had my own discovery to talk, a couple of them to talk about at the time, which, you know, but by the way, I had started Inner Fish before we found Tiktaalik.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so wow. I was already on the way writing Interfish. Right. And I was like, you know, thinking, oh, it's going to be great. I'm loving it. I'm loving life. I mean, talking about like the relationship between, you know, middle ear bones and jaws, and, uh-huh. you know, and uh-huh. mandibular and things like that. And then all of a sudden we found Tiktaalik. I'm like, oh, chapter one. Yeah, there we go. And that was my vehicle. And then all of a sudden, yeah, but I had actually begun it before we.
Right, right. I think it's appropriate that we're putting this on a podcast, but it was sort of the rise of new media. You know, you're active on Twitter, for example, but with new media, Instagram and blogs and podcasts and so forth, what do you think the importance of young scientists being aware of and being engaged with these media is? And what would your thoughts be on, you know, how to go about it, how to get your start in science communication?
Well, I think that getting a start in scientific communication is the key things with that, whether it's new media or old, uh-huh. is, you know, what's your voice?
Uh-huh.
You know, what's your niche? What can you bring to this? Everybody can.
Right.
Right. Each of us have our own voice and our own way of seeing things.
Right.
And it's and all can be powerful.
Right.
Right. So it's finding yours, which is key. Then that was a lot of doing Interfish and other things. For me, it was finding my own voice, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then also, what's the science that matters? What's you want to convey?
Right.
You know, I try to avoid political chit-chat on anything because it can really get in the way.
Right.
But it's hard to sometimes.
Yeah.
But particularly in social media.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really coupling an understanding of what science you want to communicate with your own voice and approach.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that, you're doing great. And that's what I encourage people to do. Develop your voice.
Right. That's fantastic. And as we're about to wrap up, so what are the next big questions you think that ought to be answered with the fish tetrapod transition? What's the next big piece that's waiting to be pulled out of the genes or the fossils?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what makes digits? You know, so we know about the Hox genes. We know about Sonic Hedgehog. We know about the genes. But how does a gene or a network of genes or an ensemble of genes, how do they control pattern itself?
Right.
How do you translate from the activity of genes and proteins
uh-huh.
to the actual developmental, you know, the physics and chemistry of cells interacting to make fingers and toes, things
right.
like that?
Right.
I think that is, you know, that's a big desire to know that at a level of molecular biology and embryology. But I think understanding that will help a lot with just general evolutionary issues as well.
Right. And sort of about the timeline of the transition that we've been talking about, how confident are you about that timeline? Is it likely that we might find something much earlier with more derived characteristics, for example, that might sort of blow the relationships out of the water? Is that a possibility?
Sure. It's a possibility. I wouldn't, you know, look, put it this way. I wouldn't bet on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I make a bet when I do field work.
Yeah.
I have to make a true bet.
Right.
You know, I'm the one who spends the money and risks my life uh-huh. to find these things. Uh-huh. You know? And I think, you know, I think based on my best impression that, you know, where we're going to find the fossils that are relevant will be in the Foramenian, you know, Foramenian. But, you know, anything can happen. I mean, that's science, right? That's what makes it fun.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't claim, you know, truth.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
you know, we're doing the best we can with the information we have.
That's
and
fantastic.
Then information we changes.
Right. And last question, of course, I've got to ask you this. What's your favorite fish and why?
What's my favorite fish and why? I like a mola.
A mola, right?
Yes,
sunfish, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're kind of bizarre. You know, I look at them, I see them swimming around in Cape Cod or running around Woods Hole, and I'm like, you are so odd, you know? I like things that just seem so improbable, and
a
mola is kind of improbable.
Hopeful monster.
It's a hopeful,
of,
hopeless.
Right. Monster. Hopeless. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Neil. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on Paleocast. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, sure.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/Paleocast to get all the latest news.